From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in late 2018 when an influential fashion blogger named Garance Doré surprised her followers on Instagram. She's got 750,000 followers, and her exciting life was sort of always on display. It included travel, the newest fashions, dining in exclusive places. But on that day in late 2018, Doré wrote, "These last years have been bumpy to say the least." And then, as Carrie Baton notes in a new piece for The New Yorker, Doré posted an unusual photo, one featuring herself without any makeup. It was markedly different than her typical posts, and she wrote, quote, "What's funny is that when I look back, I started these years in the mirage of the fashion girl, living the, quote, high life. And the truth is, after a few years of exploring that world, I became miserable, and I felt very far from myself," end quote. That post received a wave of shares, comments, and support. Her followers sent her notes explaining that they felt her pain, and most importantly, they appreciated her for being her true self instead of trying to present an overly manicured version of life. But Baton points out in The New Yorker that we should be careful to assume that this kind of honest, makeup-free post is any more authentic than the others. That's because there's been a surge in so-called getting real posts, in which high-profile people post pictures of a messy home, a sad face, a rainy afternoon. And new research by marketing companies confirms this trend, Baton explains. The consensus is that, at least on Instagram, the art of influencing is now about relatability, not perfection. Baton concludes, quote, "At their worst, such posts pull the same trick as aspirational content. They leverage insecurity for profit. Instagram is still an ad-driven marketplace, and influencers, after posting a getting real moment, will often follow up by thanking fans for their support and commiseration, or sometimes they announce a brand new partnership or a new brand partnership," end quote. All of which leads us to wonder, what constitutes authenticity online? What's real? What's not? How can we tell? And when we present ourselves online, are we being authentic? Is that us? Are we just performing in some way? Our guests this hour are going to dig deep into this. Elise Miklich is here, a social media specialist and owner of Light Within Candle Company. Elise, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me.
Hello to Rashad Smith, who is a creative strategist for WLGZ The Beat and the visionary of Power Hour. Welcome. What's Power Hour?
Power Hour is the after-work networking experience. Evan, it's so good to be back on the show.
Nice to have you. Thanks for being here. Hello to Kate Myers-Emery, manager for digital engagement at the George Eastman Museum and a Finger Lakes wine educator. Welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And hello to Emily Hesney Lynch, digital strategist and founder of Serve Me the Sky Digital. Welcome to you as well.
Great to be back. Thanks, Evan.
Is that the real you online, Emily?
I think so. I mean, I try.
Are you questioning that now? Or are we getting inside? No, it's interesting. I mean, I know your dogs maybe better than I know you now.
I post a lot of dog photos.
You got two of them. But I want to ask all of you how this piece in The New Yorker sort of hit you as we talk about this idea of the getting real post, the real me, the pull back the curtain, and just how much sort of cachet those kinds of posts have gotten. What do you make of that, Emily?
I see a lot of them around social media, and I think it's a really interesting issue because we do want to have more authenticity online. You know, the word sounds meaningless almost because we're saying it so much these days. But it is important to show that everything's not all perfection and glorious, wonderful, glamorous life. But at the same time, some of those imperfect moments start to become really curated. So it's kind of fascinating to take a look at those.
Kate, what do you think?
Yeah, I think in my own social media, especially doing a lot of local wine sharing, I've noticed that people do tend to like the photos that are like me holding a wine glass with a completely messy room that's been trashed by my 16-month-old. And so, of course, that's then going to feed into me taking more photos of like, hey, here's wine and a floor covered in toys. And so it is, I think it is performative and not necessarily authentic in what the word originally meant, but is this new like brand of authenticity.
I want to put a pin in that, the idea of sort of the wine glass and diapers, because we're going to come back to that in just a second. Rashad, what do you think?
You know, I think that there were some recurring themes in this piece. What I like the most about it, I sort of pointed out level insecurities for profit, and you mentioned it too. And I mean, if you can do that, if one is successful at doing that, then do it. And so I think that it's an opportunity for us to really analyze the difference between us putting on makeup, or do we allow that, or do we take off the makeup and make it profitable?
Elise, what do you think?
I think, one, this piece really solidified why I love working behind the scenes in social media and why I have not chosen to put myself out there as any sort of influencer. But it also kind of begs the question for all of us to ask what our purpose is on social media.
Wow. For you, then, what is your purpose? Because you don't spend a lot of time in a forward-looking way, not as sort of with your own name and face. You're doing a lot of work sort of behind the scenes. What is the purpose on social media?
I mean, besides, of course, connecting with other people, for me, the purpose is to just stay in touch with my family, with my friends, and to make sure that I am showing the real me. I think that's why we have privacy settings and all those sorts of things.
But how do you measure what the real you is?
Hmm.
So this part of this piece brought up spiritual awakening, and it talked about how this piece kind of shows that, are we having a spiritual awakening online because we are all of a sudden showing who the real us is? And I think that you can tell if you're being authentic by if you're questioning what your thoughts are, then drawing conclusions about those thoughts, and then acting on them. I think that if you are going through that process and you feel that it is true to you, then you hope that your followers will see the same thing.
Mm-hmm. Rashad, what's the purpose of social media use for you in your life?
You know, that's a great question. Originally, it was you know, family and friends. Mm-hmm. When I remember Facebook, even before Facebook, we had MySpace, right? And so that was
to go way back then.
Way back, right? but we can go even further back to Black Planet and Mahente, which were these culturally related social media platforms. But for me, it's always been about connecting with family and friends, and then it sort of transcended into an opportunity for business, an opportunity to speak to people on an international level. First, it started off with community, those who I knew closely to me. But I think that is a great question, and Elise, I think you posed that correctly. Overall, I think that social media is the hub for all things existing in 2020.
Oh, man.
Yeah.
That's going to scare some people.
That's going to scare people. But anything that you need, you can, you know, now when I'm researching, I will often pull up these tools where I research, but I'll also pull up the Facebook search tool because you can find a massive amount of information. Now, of course, differentiating what's real and what's fake is the issue. And I think that one can do that, but you can find a massive amount of information just in the Facebook search.
Mm. Emily, what's social? What's the purpose of social for you?
Well, for me, it's become my career. So I'm a social media strategist, and I help a lot of nonprofits and small businesses locally. So there is definitely a business purpose to it. And I use it to market my own business since I'm a social media consultant. So for me, it's an interesting line to walk because I've merged my personal and business brands. So my personal brand is my business brand, and I'm trying to share in a way where I'm not overly self-promotional, just hyping myself up all the time. I'm sharing snippets of my real life, like my dogs and the books I'm reading, as well as what I'm doing as a businesswoman.
Kate, I'm thinking about sort of the baby bottle and the wine bottle for a couple of reasons. In a minute, I'm going to read a section from the New Yorker piece that kind of stands out to me. But before I do that, we probably can all think of a couple of different sort of categories of friends on social media. There's the people whose lives are perfect, and not just the influencer with 750,000 followers, but also, you know, your friend who's every post, the child is buffed up, there's not a hair wrong, it's a sunset, it's great, my life is amazing, and you're going, bleh, you know, because you're going, that can't be your life. That is not real. And then there's people you feel like, wow, it's like this wave of venting and there's a lot of pain or frustration. And those are sort of the polars. What I'm thinking is this. What you talked about is not inauthentic. That is your life. There's a wine glass and there's a baby bottle. That's real life. The choice is, do I post this? Why do I post it? Is it good for my sort of brand and the work that I do? And we have a lot of choice on what we decide to post and present. Does that become performative? Because I think those parts of your life, that's still your life, right? There's a baby. There's a wine bottle. That's real. That's not fake, right?
Yeah, I think it's about what we decide to share and not share. So it's, I mean, there have been mornings where it's 8 a.m., but the light is really great, and I'm out in the backyard in my pajamas taking photos of wine bottles on the grass for a good photo. And clearly, like, I'm not drinking at that point. I'm just I'm taking a photo of it. And then there are times when, like, I don't have the opportunity, and it's, you know, me playing around on the kitchen floor with my child, like, all right, I'm just going to take a photo now. And it does feel more real, but I'm still setting things up. I'm still making the decision of, like, all right, I'm going to push this out of the frame because that's too much of my real life versus like that's too messy, that's too dirty.
I'm going to put a copy of Infinite Jest on the shelf and I'm going to take out Us Weekly.
And exactly. Kate, don't you choose not to show your baby's face in most of your photos?
Yes. So I tend to show my child. It's either you just see their head or you see their back or you see hands, but you don't see them because I've made that decision not to share them.
Oh,
and so I'm, even though I think my feed is feeling a little more, I guess, quote unquote, authentic or a little more real since I've had a child, I'm still making a lot of decisions about what I'm sharing and what I'm not sharing and what's omitted from this image.
So I'm thinking of a couple of points that the piece has me thinking about. Intentionally making life look worse is different than saying, hey, this messy part of my life, it is my life, I'm going to choose to share part of it. Mm. So let me read from the piece. Quote, the getting real moment is so prevalent that there's a new podcast, The Low Light Reel, that attempts to celebrate unfiltered moments or points of personal struggle. The show's host, Embry Roberts, invites entertainers, writers, and influencers to discuss the stuff you don't see on social media, which includes eating disorder, anxiety medication, imposter syndrome, health scares. The irony, of course, is that this is now the stuff that you do see on social media. Mm-hmm. The trend is now toward deliberately sloppy pictures when we post. In fact, many teens are going out of their way to make their photos look worse in an effort to appear authentic, end quote. That, to me, is a line that is mildly disturbing. I don't know how you feel about that.
Yeah, I think that's getting into a very different realm. That's a fake reel.
Yeah.
Which I think increasingly we're able to see that of, like, okay, this is not really a photo of you, like, lying in bed messy because you just woke up. Like, you've constructed this scenario. And mm-hmm. I think people are kind of catching on to
the inauthentic authenticity.
The inauthentic authentic.
Yeah. And I wonder if there will be sort of a roll your eyes, mild, like, underground backlash to it. But right now there's some cachet to it. Emily, what do you think of that idea of sort of the deliberately staged messiness?
It's interesting. I haven't done it myself personally, but I do see it a lot online. It's not uncommon at all. And I don't know. I don't know what compels people to do it other than falling into this trend. And sometimes I feel like, who are we to judge whether it's real authenticity or fake authenticity? Just, like, let the person live. But at the same time, I have looked at a photo and been like, that's totally fake. You staged that.
I love how it's like, let everybody live, be above that. But then you find yourself going, ugh. You know,
it's hard to stop sometimes.
Well, it's hard to, we're all human. Rishab, what do you make of this kind of trend?
You know, it's really interesting. As a publicist, I'm often packaging and staging opportunities that,
like,
are not
wine bottles at 7 a.m. in the grass.
Yeah, but the difference is I'll probably drink it. but I'm often staging these opportunities that are real. So it's sort of like real. You know, but my question is, who decides what is authentic? Is it self? Is it others? You know, it would be great if Mark Zuckerberg could sort of have an authentic badge. Every time you post, something is deemed authentic or not authentic. But no one is deciding that. For the young people, though, which is always a focus point of mine.
You're youngish.
I'm youngish. but I think that it's really important that they're educated on why posting fake real or real fake is not cool. You know, social media is a platform to present yourself. And so it's the same thing as if I presented myself on a stage doing a TED Talk or a Rapid Talk, which you'll find at Power Hour. Me doing a TED Talk and I'm just sort of up there as this complete mess. No, I want to be able to present myself in the best way possible. And so when we think about what's authentic, I'm struggling with that because I think that it's an opportunity for people to have the option to say, this is me on a good day and this is me on a bad day. This is just me.
Elise, what do you think?
I'm thinking about a conversation I had with a student who works in our office this morning. I told her I was going to be on the show, and I said, what do you think of this topic? And she said, oh, you're talking about relatable girl syndrome. And I said, what is that? I've never heard of that. She said, oh, it's on YouTube. You know, when YouTube stars are talking about their life, but they come from either really, you know, high class backgrounds, but they pretend and insert things that they feel will make their followers or viewers relate to them more, even if they're really not true.
Did she mention Emma Chamberlain by chance?
She
Are
did
any
not.
Of you familiar with her? Mm-hmm. She is the queen of what they call slacker YouTube.
Oh.
So it's like the most half-assed YouTube, but she's still putting a ton of work into it. She doesn't put on makeup. She's wearing sweatpants. She's talking about her life. She burps on camera constantly. I find it disgusting. Mm. But people love it. They think she's amazing. She was just on the cover
Why?
Of...
Because she's supposed to be so real?
She's so real.
Yeah.
With air quotes.
Yeah.
So
and she's like, oh, I spent 20 hours editing this video that I recorded at home by myself. And she's just
so why
burping
does,
away.
Why does this work? That's somebody who's obsessed with the performance of authenticity as opposed to just living. And we're getting into this meta kind of version. And that's where the other part of the piece really hit me, where the writer, Carrie Baton's asking us to kind of question whether the platform itself is causing us unhappiness. Because in the supposed getting real posts, it's like, hey, guys, I've been sort of maybe not living a lie, but my life isn't as perfect as it looks. I'm depressed. I'm dealing with a lot of stuff. And people go, oh, wow. But Carrie's saying, we should be really asking ourselves if the platforms themselves are going to make us feel this way sort of inevitably. Let me read from her piece. Getting real posts vary widely in their substance, but their tone is meant to signal a moment of catharsis. I have been living a lie, the Instagrammers explain, as if their followers had been naive enough to take prior posts at face value. At their best, these posts offer moments of relief to the follower, not to mention a voyeuristic jolt. But there's plenty of deception, if not delusion, in them, too. Most of them sidestep the inconvenient fact that distress is an occupational hazard of life online. Although Instagram has been well documented as one of the most demoralizing places on the internet, it's easier to post about insecurity and isolation as if they flowed solely from external factors rather than from the powerful consuming platform by which many of these people make their livelihood. End quote. That's tough because that's making you think, maybe I'm just going to be happier if I get off entirely. What do you think, Elise?
I actually do practice that regularly.
Social media, no, for like a week, a month?
The longest I've done so far without it at all has been a week. And you do feel different afterwards. But I think it also kind of brings up the question, it's like what came first, chicken or the egg thing. You know, you have these people that are influencers, they're showing their lives in a curated way, but performance can also be therapeutic to them. They get to hide from things, they get to run from things, they get to live differently. But then it comes back to seeing other people like that and knowing that's not real, and it's just this cycle.
Hmm. Rashad, what do you make of the platform maybe being the problem?
You know, this respected publication in the UK, Evening Standard, they wrote this piece, part of my research here. Just 5 minutes scrolling through images of celebrities on social media is enough to make young people unhappy with their looks. And so I just sort of take that and try to connect it all with folks who are being real. Is it an opportunity now for those young people who maybe were social media shamed or Instagram shamed? Is it an opportunity for them to change that perspective and say everything isn't glitz and glamour? And so do I fault the people who are out here creatively, strategically packaging their Instagram stories or posts to be very real? Maybe not, because maybe it's making a change in the lives of so many who look at Instagram as this, you know, hero.
Okay. Emily?
One thing to note about the platform is that it really favors engagement and comments. So if you post one of those getting real style posts, you might get a ton of comments like, oh my God, I never knew that about you, or I can relate, or I feel that. And then those posts rise up higher in the algorithm. More people see them in their feed. More people like and comment. So there is something to the way the platform is structured that almost encourages that type of content versus a very beautiful picture of your brunch or something that gets likes but not comments.
Do you think the platform itself, though, makes people miserable if we're not careful?
I don't know if you can fully blame the platform and not the people. I think we're all conscious people making choices. So,
yeah, I think that that's generally fair. I mean, I think Elise is sort of split in the difference with occasional breaks, and we'll talk more about that in a minute. What do you make of the possible toxicity of the platform?
I think given the algorithm that it is kind of supporting these toxic posts potentially, and I mean, they are making decisions on what content we see, what content we don't see, and that can potentially feed these things, but it could also feed very positive things. I mean, I think this whole authentic, real movement can be a lot easier. It can be more relatable. It can feel better to people who don't feel like, all right, you know, I don't have to take a trip to Jamaica to feel good about myself. Like, there's a lot of people who are just taking local trips, mm-hmm. and that's great. And they're seeing things that are more relatable, potentially. But then it's, yeah, you know, what are they liking? If you're liking content that's actually real, you're going to see more of that content.
I think there's something interesting in when we think about the potential of social media, the good potential, and there's a lot of different layers here. I mean, certainly it can be really good for brands. It can be really good to reach customers. It can be really good to get feedback and then deal with problems if you do it well. And that's what some of our guests in this room help people do every day. And we see a lot of good examples of that. But just in terms of interaction, I actually think it can be really good. And I even said that this week. Like, I am going to have to get a new car soon. It's a pain. I don't want to deal with it. It's been 12 years. And people have had all these great ideas. I mean, I'm learning so much from people who are just happy to share. And it's cool. And then other people are watching those conversations, and they'll jump in, and they'll add, or they'll ask questions. And it's been really cool. And yet I got a comment from somebody who said, Evan, can you do a single thing without asking people on Twitter about their opinions first? And I went, huh. So I actually responded, no, here's the weird thing. Like, social media can really sort of suck, but it can actually be social. And I actually like people, and I like hearing about their experiences. And the person wrote back and said, I'm blocking you for that, for using social media in a social way. It's like we're addicted to using social media to flame people. And when you notice people actually just being friendly and talking about stuff, it feels jarring. So let me ask all of you, and I'll go back around the table. Why, Kate, if there are these good potentials, do we see so much energy on social in flaming, in dragging, in pylons, all the toxic stuff? Mm-hmm. Why?
I think social media is basically everyone has this individual silo, and you create a silo around you. And so to a certain extent, you hear conversations that you want to hear, and they can be potentially negative. If you start liking negative content, if you start following people who are being more negative, it kind of just feeds into that. And you can end up in this really kind of dark space versus ending up in a very happy, helpful space, which it can be. I think my Twitter is this amazing environment for me where I can ask people for help on projects, and I hear really exciting things that are happening in Rochester. But I know that Twitter's not that way for everybody. So we kind of build these things around us, and it can very quickly become toxic if we start kind of chasing these like rabbit holes into different conversations.
Hmm. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Kate has a great point about building your own silo, and the algorithms definitely favor polarization and vitriol. One thing that I was going to point out is today on iHeartRock, a project that I run on the side, we had a post go out where a man was holding a sign that said, homophobes are just too scared of black people to be racist. So it's a funny sign. I was at Park Ave Fest. He was protesting the protesters of Pride. And he has gotten 791 likes on this photo, but we're up to 35 comments. People never comment on our photos this much. And the comments just feed it and boost it in the algorithm. There have been some hateful people criticizing him, but mostly people jumping to his defense against these critical homophobes attacking him. So it's getting so much engagement, so much traction. It's only going to be seen by more and more people because of that.
So vitriol has more velocity and sort of
than kindness.
Than kindness.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know the saying, if it bleeds, it leads, right?
Still true, I guess.
And it's very much so still true, probably more now than ever. The owner of this online platform that first started it out on Instagram, but now a website called The Shade Room. So the founder of The Shade Room, Angelica Nwindu, this African beautiful lady who has morals and ethics, but she is now rich off of messiness. And so she hosted a digital workshop yesterday, and I tuned in, and it talked about a question that I asked myself as I prepare for this: how do we leverage social media for what we need to be successful? And so all of us are doing that in our respective fields. And so here you have Angelica of The Shade Room, who has created an opportunity. She knows that what bleeds leads. She's created this opportunity to make money off it. But what does that do? So yes, I tune into The Shade Room sometimes because I like a little ratchetness sometimes. But I also know the impact that that can have on the culture and young people. And so I think that conversation and dialogue about that content is necessary, whether it be negative or positive. You'll often find folks, if you go into any column, any post on Instagram, you'll have folks who are for it and against it. And I just think that type of dialogue, unless it's extremely bizarre or crazy, is helpful to the overall goal. And that is, all right, how do we deal with, how do we handle, how do we manage our social media perceptions, portrayals of us, of our communities on these networks?
Elise?
This brought up, you know, thinking about why it's still negative. I think that talking about the algorithm and how it's boosting all of these posts, it brought up this thought that sometimes it creates a disadvantage to be vulnerable if you don't have built-in support. So if you don't already have 100,000 followers that you know comment and that you know before you hit post, even if you get negative comments, you still know you're going to get a lot of support for that. It empowers you to post that. And I think it goes back to my own use of social media, whereas why I don't always post some things that are super real or personal is I love my friends, but do I have that safety net of knowing that when I post something online, I'm going to get a flood of positivity supporting me that I know is going to be there?
But let me ask you a question. Let's say you posted something really vulnerable. What does support look like? Is one comment on Facebook saying, oh, thinking about you, is that real support?
I think it depends. Yeah. I think it depends on who it comes from.
Yeah.
And I think there's social media support and real life support. Someone might text you afterwards and be like, oh, I saw your post. I'm worried about you. Are you okay? Do you want to get lunch or something?
Yep.
Versus someone saying it on social media. Mm-hmm. The social media backup is nice and it looks good and it supports being vulnerable on social, but the real life one is probably a little more important.
Yeah. Right. And I think that's just something that, I mean, we all never really know how to deal with those situations, right? And so showing someone that we care, like for me, you know, the happy birthday post, like, you know, I literally every year since being on Facebook, I make it an effort to go in and like every comment. And like I'm at 5,000 likes at this point. But
I mean, people are wishing you happy birthday.
Wishing me a happy birthday. It just says something to show that people are thinking about you because, I mean, they can literally scroll past it. And so the fact that they stopped on it is interesting. So you made an interesting point too, Elise. You talked a little bit about us already having this following. So one of my friends in the community, Damon Meeks, he's running for political office, right? So it's very interesting. Now he has to step his game up to be on social media. And so he said something really funny to me. He said, I couldn't believe it. There were like 400 people that were already trying to be my friend. And I'm like, you got a long way to go. Because folks are out here with 5,000 and 10,000 folks who they're engaging with. I think that it says something when people do show that type of support, even if it's a like. And I try to evaluate that myself. Like, how deep am I digging into this whole I want to be accepted on social media
thing? But to you, there is some value, even in a brief comment, even in a like. That kind of a
value
thing.
There.
Okay. Kate, is there for you?
I think it depends on if you're being vulnerable just to get likes, or if you're being vulnerable because you're actually feeling vulnerable and want support. I think there are people that the end is just, all right, I got 500 likes. Good. I don't feel vulnerable anymore.
Like a dopamine hit, right?
I think it's that rush of like, oh, I got all these comments and all these people like me and look at all these new followers. So it is that kind of getting back to that authenticity. If you're opening up and being vulnerable because this is a good platform and you're feeling like, you know, I want to reach out and I need help from people, then getting a text message maybe is the best possible thing.
Well, and like, let me just say, I hope no one listening thinks that like the host thinks like we're above that. Like, I'm not above that. Like, I've had those moments. I've literally met one person in my life who could not care less about whether she's getting likes, and that's producer Megan Mack. It's like, she doesn't care. She's not in it for the likes, not in it for the clicks.
But isn't it something about support, though?
Except for if she's posting about her dog, then lots of likes.
Then you got to like that. Yeah. Isn't it something about support? Like, it's the same thing if we were hosting an event or wanted people to support something that is not online. The fact that people are there to support you, to hear your voice on this platform, isn't there value there?
Yeah, I mean, as a business owner, when people like my tweets or reshare them, it gets me in front of new people and they can see, oh, this girl's a social media expert. Cool. Mm-hmm. I didn't know about her before. It really does help.
Yeah. So we are excited when we reach 500, 1,000 likes.
Definitely.
Let me get Tom in Brighton on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
Yeah. Look, I'm getting past 70 at this point. I'm a little bit older than some of you. But when I was younger, it seems to me there's been a lot more increase in frequency of the use of the word really in our verbal speech. I mean, it's used so frequently. You can't speak with anyone or listen to the radio or television and not hear that word used in speech. And it was not used, to my memory, nearly as much 10, 20, 30, certainly 40 and 50 years ago. Even 60 years ago. And I wonder if you've observed this yourself, and I wonder what it means. Is it that there's a general sense among all of us, me included, that people in general are not being sincere, are not, as you've been putting it, are not being authentic in what they're saying or what people are seeing?
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, so, Tom, I'm going to see if I can follow the thread here. Thanks for the phone call. So when he's hearing really, he may also be hearing things like literally when it actually means figuratively, which I did hear recently the dictionaries are thinking about adding a definition of literally to basically connote. No, Kate. It is not figuratively. I draw the line. Literally means literally.
I think it's literally awesome.
No. Oh.
Is it literally or literally?
Literally.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
But I think what Tom hears real or really a lot and wondering, is that sort of a verbal tick associated with a desire to express authenticity? I have no idea. I don't hear it as much, but maybe I'm not noticing it. You guys hear it?
I don't know. I think I probably said it a couple of times on the show.
I have to go back over.
You know, but that's language, you know. SMH wasn't used 35 years
that's
ago.
That's right. Language evolves.
It evolves. And so that is an interesting point, though. Still trying to understand the point, but language evolves.
Thank you, Tom. As we go to our only break of the hour, I want to read something for our guests to kind of think about, and we're going to come back and talk about this. I thought this email from a listener was really interesting. Benjamin writes, Evan, 5 or 6 years ago, my daughter and I were watching one of my sons in a football game, and my daughter was miserable. Another friend arrived with a hot chocolate for her. She's miserable, but she takes a picture of the Starbucks cup, faces the field, takes the shot, and then types best day ever in all caps and posts it. Ever since, I've largely left social media. For me, it is too toxic and generally gross for me. Benjamin's saying, here's someone who was having, quite literally, a miserable day, but still wanted to post to social media that this is awesome. I'm drinking Starbucks and I'm going to get a game. And for him, it just felt so inauthentic as to be so misrepresentative of what someone was experiencing that he thought, what is the point? What are we doing here? I find that very interesting. We're going to ask our guests what they think about that on the other side of this break. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, Arun Gandhi joins us in the first hour with a conversation about what he calls the gift of anger. Then in our second hour, Garth Fagan talking about a citywide celebration of Black culture. So much to celebrate and explore. Talk with you Monday on your member-supported public radio. I'm Evan Dawson. Carrie Baton wrote a piece for The New Yorker called The Rise of the Getting Real Post on social media. And that's the spark for this conversation about what is authentic and what is not in our online presentation of ourselves. Elise Miklisch is here, social media specialist and owner of Light Within Candle Company. Rashad Smith is creative strategist for WLGZ The Beat and the visionary of the Power Hour. Kate Myers-Emery, manager for digital engagement at the George Eastman Museum and a Finger Lakes wine educator. Emily Hesney Lynch is a digital strategist and founder of Serve Me the Sky Digital. So Benjamin observes his daughter, miserable, but then decides, I'm going to post anyway and make it seem like I'm having a great day with this cup of Starbucks at a game. And he was really turned off by that. Would you be turned off by that, Emily?
I don't know. I think maybe the Starbucks really did make her day, but it also makes me think of a therapy concept of editing your own story. And social media is kind of a way, even for yourself, of curating your life. Like, maybe you're having a crappy day, but maybe the Starbucks did make your day and it made you smile and you wanted to share like the small moment that made you happy. I wouldn't be so quick to condemn the daughter.
Okay, Kate?
Yeah, I think when we take photographs, it does something to the way that we remember an event. And by sharing a photograph of us happy in a moment where maybe we aren't, it actually does impact the way that we view the past. I know I look back at my own social media sometimes and I forget the challenges that came with those days. And I just see these happy photos and these amazing things that I did. And I forget about, you know, the challenge we went through to like get that family photo or the day that happened leading up to like this amazing adventure. So in a way we are kind of shaping our memory, and she might look back and say, that was a really great day. And I do remember that. And this could be a really positive thing.
Okay. Elise?
I think Emily made a really good point about the editing your own story, but the first thing that came to mind was that his daughter might have been reaching for the dopamine fix. She is going to get likes and comments on that photo, and even if it wasn't a great day, she might feel good about herself when she sees those comments rolling in. But it also is kind of scary because it shows that we really are kind of skipping over these feelings. We're becoming more uncomfortable with feeling bad about ourselves. And so we are skipping over the feelings and immediately jumping to that dopamine fix.
Rashad?
Yeah, good point, Elise. I think that it's, you know, I think about the book, Alexander and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. And if Instagram posts was a thing then, what might that have made Alex feel like? But you talk about skipping over the problems that we are facing. Extremely, extremely important to be able to deal with them and not allow the judgment of others mm-hmm. to make us feel better.
I think these are really profound points. And I kind of want to remind myself to keep Emily Hesney Lynch's point in mind earlier. You know, you got to let people live and people cope and grapple with things the way they do. And it's easy to just apply the standard for how you would do things and assume they must do things that way. At the same time, I think it's fair to ask us if we are not always grappling with emotion. And I think generally speaking, the more we engage with emotion on all parts of the spectrum, it's a good thing. So if we are burying sadness, if we are burying or trying to bury sadness, you know, a friend of mine used to call it filling up your knapsack. You keep filling it, eventually it's going to burst out and everything's going to fall on the floor. And it's going to be much worse than if you never put it in the knapsack to begin with. So I find it, but at the same time, I kind of don't want to police other, you know what I mean? It's kind of this push-pull, very interesting. Andy writes to us on Twitter and says, we all need to stop comparing ourselves to what we see on each other's social media feeds. Social media is what we make of it. Follow accounts that inspire happiness and awe, enjoy and move on, and post the same on our own, whatever that means. That's true authenticity. That is from Andy. Sheila says, interesting conversations, but focusing on Insta without mentioning TikTok and Snapchat is leaving out a lot of teenagers. Also, many students have finstas, fake Instas. So they might be more aware of fakery than we realize. My worry is the elimination of gray areas in critical thought. Finstas is new to me, and I try to be cool. Finstas? Everybody?
I feel like I've heard you mention that before.
I know, I don't.
No, that's I thought you knew it.
Nope, that's new to me. So you knew Finstas? Yeah. You know Finstas? Everybody know Finstas?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay.
I was surprised when I heard about it, though. I learned about it from my partner's younger sister, and I actually accidentally blurted out an expletive at the kitchen table at his mother's house when she said a finsta, and I said, "What the is that?"
What the finsta?
There you go. And by the way, Ben is calling us. He's the father of the daughter with the Starbucks cup. So I want to bring him in. And by the way, Ben occasionally will email, and I will say this, Benjamin, your emails are always so illuminating, and they're so good for the show. And it's nice that you called. How are you?
I'm good, Evan. Thank you. It's wonderful to finally talk to you.
Yeah. So go ahead.
So I guess regarding the comments, one, the hot chocolate did not make her more happy. She was still complaining and wanting to go. And two, I think, you know, as far as regarding repainting your memories, I think when you let go of negative things that have happened to you, you lose an opportunity to grow. And I think that's dangerous. I think, you know, you want to experience the entire human condition and learn from it and then move forward in a positive way, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it does. And you decided, Ben, that you didn't want to get on social because it sounds like you thought, man, if this is what people are posting, then I am definitely not seeing the real them. That's kind of how I read that. Is that correct?
That is correct. And then addition to politics, were just getting so thick at the time. And it was really, you know, people that you care about, that you're connected to, and it would end up being too grouchy and lack of listening to each other.
Listen, social media, if anything, has taught us that we've got family members with terrible views on lots of things. And it's
agreed.
And they probably feel that way about us. But that's been illuminating. But I hope you don't take, I mean, I think our guests were kind of working through the possibilities there. So I'll let them respond now.
Sure.
But thanks for making the call. And thanks for emailing as well, Ben.
Thank you all.
So he's saying he's a little worried that we're not really processing. Kind of builds on what you were saying. You want to add to that, Elise, now?
Yeah, I think that it's just a tough place to be in. Mm-hmm. Even with talking about how people want to be inspirational on social media, I think the desire to provide others with inspiration can easily allow you to fall into curation because you want to inspire. You're there to inspire.
That was Bo Burnham's movie, Eighth Grade, which I thought was profound and horrifying and really beautiful. But yes, an eighth grader, a girl who is desperate to be like, to have influence, to inspire others, but sort of miserable in her own, I guess, life outside of online. I'm not going to say authentic life because, again, I think all of this is complex. But yeah, that movie stayed with me. What do you think, Rashad?
Yeah, you know, I don't want folks to think that, like, social media is this huge sea of catfish, the TV show. Mm-hmm. you know, we talk a lot about, all right, well, who identify us as these authentic people? Who are the judges? So it's probably our friends and our followers. And I think that there's something said to that. So oftentimes, even with me, so I'm involved with all of these things in the communities, hands in different pots, wearing different hats. But and people think that I'm rich. And I'm like, no, I'm not rich. But because what I package and what I present, that will probably have folks thinking that this guy is doing everything. He has to have money. No, that's not the case. Oftentimes, it's really, you know, things from the heart. And so, excuse me, I think us, as these folks who package social media stories, even in our own lives, we have the ability to know how to, you mentioned earlier about shaping, not really being full of yourself on social media, but really sharing these real moments and stories. And so I think that we have to be able to differentiate the two, you know.
Emily, what do you make of Ben's phone call?
I have a couple examples that come to mind in response to that because he was talking about the human condition and mm-hmm. experiencing emotion and all of that. So one person who I think does a really good job of that is Kate Spear on Instagram. She's the CEO of a company called The Doggist, but she also suffers from severe PTSD and was hospitalized for all kinds of mental conditions and misdiagnosed. So when she shares on Instagram, she doesn't share in the heat of that PTSD moment, but afterwards she shares, I had this really horrible flare-up. This is how I get over it, but this is what PTSD looks like. And she really tries to be a mental health advocate in that way. So I think she's bringing followers in after she's kind of experienced and processed the moment. Versus the other example I think of, a girl spoke at a conference I was at last year, and she talked about breaking up with her fiance and then getting on Instagram stories crying so she could be authentic with her followers and share transparently how she was feeling. So I think there's a huge difference between these two. She's like going to Instagram to get validation and get comfort and share these tears, and the other woman is actually processing the emotion first.
Okay.
I keep thinking about digital literacy, of that we are in this world where social media is everywhere. It's not a fad. It's not going away. This is going to keep happening, and that it's really important that people are learning how to decipher what's real, what's constructed, what might be in this kind of gray area in between, starting to look at social media as a really complicated place, that there's a lot going on, that these are real people who might be struggling, even though they look like they're rich or they look like they're going to wineries every weekend, which is something I hear. Like, oh, you went to another winery. It's like, no, I went 6 months ago and have just been sharing posts since then because I have no free time. And I think we need to kind of teach that more. It needs to be embedded in education. We need to be telling people about how to decipher these things, and we need to just talk more about digital literacy.
Well, Kat writes to say, Evan, I'm 71. Kat writes on Twitter, I'm 71 and came to social media as an adult. Initially, my goal was professional, but as I age and become less mobile, I find that my social life is migrating to electrons and pixels. Wow. It is a lifeline for those of us with disabilities.
Wow.
That's powerful.
I've never thought of that.
Mm-hmm. That's awesome.
That is awesome.
Yeah,
wow.
Kat, thank you for that. And great perspective for cynics to see that there is power.
Mm-hmm. You know, the age aspect is interesting, too, because when you think about teenagers spending time on the app, their brains might not be fully developed, like from a psychological perspective, and you get a lot of things ingrained about, you know, the likes and the dopamine.
And Emily, you mentioned during a brief break someone making a remark about sort of oversharing. And that question of what oversharing is very subjective. Define oversharing to you.
Well, for me, one thing I keep in mind with oversharing is I don't want to put my own privacy at risk. So I used to check in to places like my gym regularly on Yelp and then share it to Twitter. And after a while, I started getting really nervous about that because people can learn and analyze your patterns and your habits. If I post too often about the coffee shops I'm at or the places I go regularly, you could get a stalker. So that's one thing I think about when I'm trying not to overshare.
What's oversharing to you, Rashad?
Yeah, you know, great point. As you know, now having my own radio show and just being involved in the community, I thought exactly about that. So I'm like, not this nervous wreck about somebody stalking me, but those are things that to really take into consideration. Oversharing. Chanel is a character on this show called Ridiculousness on MTV, and Chanel went crazy on Instagram maybe a couple of weeks ago because people were not liking her post as often as she would like, and so she said something that was really interesting to me. She said, I don't care. Yes, I am here crying because you all are not liking my post. This is like my personal blog, my personal diary. Mm-hmm. And so I think that people have even gone beyond the personal diary and now obviously taking all of what's in a diary and exposing it to the world. But maybe that's just the way that they cope. Oversharing to me, few examples, going to a funeral, posting a picture of the guy in the casket. Oversharing.
Yeah.
Baby at birth and doing it right then and there.
Okay.
Oversharing. Those are some extreme oversharing. But guess what? They happen. And when I see them, I am stunned. But they happen. People don't necessarily know. Yeah. Am I oversharing?
Elise, define it for you.
For me, I think oversharing is when it's ironic that social is for things that happen in live time sometimes, but when things are happening in live time, if you're having a fight with your spouse and you take to Facebook to detail that fight to everyone in your following, and then that spouse or the spouse's mother or father gets on and joins that conversation, mm-hmm. that is oversharing.
Kate, you mentioned that social media is not going away, and you think about digital literacy. That's true. So when we think about what sort of is inbounds, out of bounds for oversharing, how do you define it?
I think it's so individual of what you feel comfortable with and what you don't. I think the photograph at a funeral is a really great example. I studied mortuary archaeology and was really into like death and the things that go along with that. And a lot of, at that time, what I was sharing was relating to death, which was very uncomfortable for people. And this thing of photographs at funerals came up, and the conversation was around, well, what if this is your way to cope?
That's right.
What if it helps you by taking a photo? I mean, it used to be a thing to take photos of dead relatives because that was the only photograph you might ever have of them. And so what if this is your way of feeling better about what you're going through?
But I think the difference, too, is that those photos were placed in photo books and not online for all of us to see.
Yeah. And thinking about what Elise said about the real-time stuff, a pretty prominent sports reporter, a woman who's been a sideline reporter for many years, recently posted, "Congratulations to our 14-year-old who recently has explained to us that he knows everything in the whole world and that there's nothing more that my husband and I need to educate him on. So join me in congratulating our son on his omniscience."
I would love to see those comments.
I know. And I'll tell you what, like, a lot of parents were like, "Been there." But I was kind of like, you're really frustrated with your kid. I'm not sure this is the moment to air this on social. And I kind of just thought of what you're saying. You agree? That's
yeah, I just
a little uncomfortable.
I don't like the idea of taking like power away from another person and airing another person's issues online without their consent.
Yeah, especially when they can't be there to sort of join that conversation. Elise, Rashad, Emily, Kate, great conversation. Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
Really
Thank
appreciate
you.
The
Thank
insight.
You.
Really great stuff. Tim Shea, thanks for volunteering. Great to have you, sir. MRA Stein, Megan Mack, producing and engineering. I'm Evan Dawson. Wherever you are, whatever platform you're on, I hope it is a loving one and you've got a great weekend, and we'll talk with you Monday on Member Supported Public Radio.